Hello everyone, welcome to the Scientific Sense podcast, where we explore emerging ideas from science, policy, economics, and technology. My name is Gil Epen. We talk with world's leading academics and experts about their recent research or general areas of topical interest. Scientific Sense is an unstructured conversation with no agenda or preparation. We cover a wide variety of domains where new discoveries are made and new technologies are developed on a daily basis. We are most interested in how ideas affect society and help educate the world how to pursue a rewarding and enjoyable life rooted in science, logic, and information. We seek knowledge without boundaries and constraints and provide unedited content of conversations with researchers and leaders who love what they do. A companion blog to this podcast can be found at scientificsense.com. And this podcast is available on over a dozen platforms and directly at scientificsense.net. If you have suggestions for topics, guests, and other ideas, please send them to info@scientificsense.com. And I can be reached at gil@epen.info. My guest today is Professor Anna Maria Lusardi, who is a senior fellow at the Stanford Institute for Economic Research, CIPER, and the director of the Initiative for Financial Decision Making, a collaboration between CIPER, the Daniel School of Business, and the Economics Department at Stanford University. Welcome, Anna Maria.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for doing this. So, this is a subject of great interest to me. I have some finance and economics background, not extensive, but the subjects that we're going to talk about today, you know, I was just wondering, it has a lot of implications, both from a policy perspective as well as from sort of a GDP growth perspective as well. And so, there's some data that we need to really sort of look at. So I would start with the importance of financial literacy opening a new field. You say here in the abstract, we undertake an assessment of two decades of research on financial literacy, building on our empirical research and theoretical work, casting financial knowledge as a form of investment in human capital. We also draw on recent data to determine who is the most and least financially savvy in the United States, and we highlight the similarity of our results in other countries. A number of convincing studies is now available, you say, from which we can draw conclusions about the effects and consequences of financial illiteracy and what can be done to fill these gaps. We conclude by offering our thoughts on implications for teaching, financial literacy programs, and future research. And so you have been doing sort of a personal finance index. Is that the right term, PFI or something like that? And we can look at that index across demographic constructs, across countries. And so what does our data tell us? Where are we in sort of the status quo today?
Yeah, so thanks for these questions because it allows me to speak about basically the research that Olivia Mitchell and I have been doing for now more than 20 years, I have to say. So we started with measuring financial literacy. And as you have also mentioned by in this new paper that we have published in the Journal of Economic Perspective, we really wanted to know how much people know about this basic concept at the basis of financial decision making. So we started, and it was a constraint actually imposed upon us with measuring financial literacy, having only three questions at our disposal. And what turned out to be a big constraint, because it was very difficult to measure financial literacy with three questions. So we had to think very hard about what to ask. And this is why it took us a long time. And at the same time, we also went to basically look at the most important and also fundamental and I would say universal concept as well at the basis of financial decision making. At the end, we measure whether people understand interest compounding or can do simple calculations in the context of interest rate, whether people know and understand the workings of inflation, and whether people know and understand the workings of risk diversifications. And as you can imagine, these are indeed the concepts that are at the basis of every financial decision that we make, but not just in the US. And I was happy to see that these big three questions, as they've become to be called, have now been adopted, not just in the US to measure financial literacy, but in most countries around the world. And
so,
to your point,
sorry to interrupt. So as a clarification, so compound interest, inflation, and sort of risk management, those are the three different things, mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, so we are really assessing knowledge of these three concepts. And because we are thinking of basically financial decisions, and financial decisions are always about time and transferring someone's money over time. And this is why we have chosen to focus on these three concepts, which are really important and fundamental. And what we have found, the questions are available on our website and so on. And as you'll see, we call them the ABC of personal finance. So they are actually very simple questions. It's not that they are really measure sophisticated knowledge, but this question, I think, have been very good in measuring basically basic knowledge. Do people have this very basic financial literacy? And the findings are fortunately are striking, which is that even in the country with the most developed financial markets like the US, we find very low level of financial literacy. In our recent paper, where we used the data from the Survey of Consumer Finances, so the data set that the Federal Reserve uses also to make monetary policy, so one of the most probably precise and trusted data set, we find that only 43% of Americans can answer these three questions, even though they are very, very basic. And also we see that when you look across the age group, even people at an older age, in a cross section, we cannot distinguish age and cohort effect, but even people who are 60 or close to 60, close to retirement, they don't seem to have a high level of knowledge. So they have probably made a lot of decisions without the knowledge of these basic concepts. When we look around the world, unfortunately, the results are the same. And this is why we have done a project. The acronym is Financial Literacy Around the World. And the acronym became FLAT World for Financial Literacy Around the World. But the world, to paraphrase Thomas Friedman, is flat in financial literacy as well, meaning that In other countries too, we see this low level of financial literacy, and we find very similar results, meaning the people who know the least or the most are the same across countries. And I'll say in a moment who they are. The concept that people know the least across countries is risk and risk diversification. And kind of the similarities, in many other dimensions of this financial literacy, how it changes across age, the gender differences, the difference across demographics are again very similar. And so, we want to say, I think maybe we have unveiled a problem that people had not seen before, and which is unfortunately important and consequential, because what has happened over time, not just in the US, but around the world, is that people are put in charge a lot more of financial decisions that before perhaps we were not making. And of course, having basic knowledge is really important to make those decisions.
Yeah, so the three questions are quite interesting. So compound interest and inflation are sort of mathematical constructs, and we potentially have a path toward that. But portfolio management or risk management, whether ETFs, mutual funds, or I don't want to pick on one company, Tesla stock, are useful instruments to invest in. That's a much more complex question, right? So, you know, we graduate a lot of MBAs all around the country, and we teach them CAPM, we teach them security market line, we teach them capital market line, and they go out and they do their own trading. And what I observe in the marketplace is that typical finance education actually doesn't really teach them what to do with finance. What's your perspective on this?
Yeah, no, thank you very much for this question, because it allows me also to speak about the personal finance course that we have been started actually as a result of this research as well. So first of all, if you look at our questions, and I want to kind of make this clear, I get this question a lot, which is, but are you mostly capturing knowledge of math? And in fact, our questions are so simple that, you know, it would be capturing super basic math knowledge.
Okay.
And even the inflation question is really a comparison between, you know, a 1% versus a 2% inflation. So it's not that it is very much of a math concept, but I would say, if any, our questions are a joint test of knowledge of finance and the concept and knowledge of the language of finance. So, for example, in the second question, we talk about inflation without defining it. And in the third question, which is also relatively simple, is not a question which really says, you know, how you should invest in ETF, or, you know, whether ETF are better than other instruments. We test really the knowledge of a stock mutual fund versus a single stock. So very much these questions are also a test of the language of finance. And I think it's important because finance has its language, and people speak the language of finance in the finance world. And so if you don't know this language, you are illiterate, right? Mm. And so, you know, I think we design those questions, and though we use those words on purpose, to kind of test whether people understand what we are talking about, right? If you read any, for example, a newspaper or a magazine related also to this topic, nobody really explained this concept to you, right? Mm. And so in a sense, you know, you have to have this type of knowledge, and our knowledge is, of course, you know, the standard one, and it is on purpose. So, you know, this question, I think, are very able to discriminate across different people, whether they know or not this concept and whether they speak the language of finance. And you are absolutely right that when we go to the risk diversification question, it is the one that is able to differentiate even more among level of financial knowledge. But then to your point, you know, because people do not know, what can we do? And more than 10 years ago, I started teaching personal finance. Mm. And to your point, you know, when I ask students what they think this course is about, they think it's about investing and investing only, which is not. It is about investing, but it is about the many financial decisions that we make, you know, from saving to planning for retirement to insuring to, you know, managing debt in our FICO score to also investing. And I also have to say that, you know, while we have always been teaching corporate finance in a business school, right, because it's very obvious that, you know, we don't want no firm, you know, would hire somebody or a CFO who doesn't have knowledge of finance. Today, we are managing, you know, our own money, and it's often quite substantial now that we are also saving and have to save and invest for our own retirement. And somehow, right, we we have not given this teaching to the people where to manage their own money, or, for example, check how much people know about this. And so I think these are important teaching. And I also think that the academic research, I think, is quite clear about how people should invest, right? And whether it's a good idea to invest in individual stock or not versus stock mutual funds. So we cover all of those topics in the personal finance course. And I'm very happy to continue to teach this course at Stanford as well, where, you know, a personal finance course started about 4 years ago in 2020. I'm very happy to report that 362 students sign up, which is a very large number. And it has become the largest and most popular course in the econ department.
That's excellent. There's so many thoughts going through my mind. So I want to start with, so we have this financial advisors, as you know.
Yeah.
They manage $105 trillion today in the US alone, $105 trillion, the latest statistic I've seen. And what is your perspective on this? Are they really financially literate? That's a loaded question. Yeah.
Well, Gil, this is a great question. And I have to say, while I would love to test their financial literacy, I have not been able to do so. So, but I want to refer to a study which I've seen recently, and I think it was published, and it was from David Robinson from Duke and another co-author, which actually have tested the financial literacy of CEO and CFO. And there as well, you know, these are the striking results, but they are not striking for me because I've seen it in the data. He found that even them, they are not financially literate or as literate as we expect those people to be. And this is why I think, you know, these tests are useful. They are almost like, you know, keeping people honest, right? Or keeping us on track. And I also want to add, you know, one important clarification, which is always important. You know, when I talk to people about financial literacy or I talk about my research, people feel like, you know, that when I say illiteracy, or that it looks like an insult, right? Yeah. That people are not knowledgeable. And the reality is, this is not an insult, first of all, and it's reality. But the reason why we are ignorant today is not because we are stupid. It's because the world is changing so fast, right? And it has changed so fast. And unfortunately, we are not catching up. I mean, I myself feel like sometimes I'm not catching up enough. You know, it's like, look at all of these new financial instruments we see, cryptos, right? Or buy now, pay later. And so the financial innovation is happening quite quickly, so much so that if young people would have to learn from their parents, they wouldn't be able to. Because, you know, parents didn't have student loan, they didn't have cryptos, they didn't have buy now, pay later, they didn't have the social media providing all of this financial advice to whoever wanted, right, to get this advice. So, you know, this is why even a CFO today might be not financially literate, because it takes, you know, the world is moving at a very fast speed, I would say, in finance. And we need to catch up. We really needed to have it in the school. I am so surprised, right? We teach corporate finance, but not personal finance. So you know, managing your own money doesn't, you know, you don't have to use the same rule. You don't have to be as rigorous. Everything goes, right? I mean, there is so much at stake, right? And also, I think as a society as well, and we have seen it, if people make financial mistakes, as taxpayer, we will be asked to pay for them. So yeah. I think it's really important that I think, you know, we pay attention to this. And maybe we do some checkups as well, that people, you know, really need to keep fresh on their knowledge, because this is changing all the time.
Yeah, so that's an important point. So physics, chemistry, and biology, well, they're changing too. But they may not be as changing as fast as financial instruments, innovation, those types of things. So whatever we teach kids at school today is quite dynamic, as you say, right? So it's not just, so I'm thinking about personal finance, which is if somebody doesn't have a structured financial education, and they go out and they do their work, and maybe he or she has a financial advisor. And as I mentioned before, it's not very clear to me if financial advisors have the expertise either. And so you are sort of put in there to manage pretty big decisions. So in the corporate finance context, you know, buying a company or, you know, getting a patent, big decisions. Actually, households are doing that too. They're buying a car, they're buying a house, they're going to school. These are really huge decisions in the context of resources they're holding, right? So I don't even know how people make these decisions. I mean, this is really puzzling, yeah.
Yeah, so two important points I want to answer here, which is how people make decision and also the relationship with financial advisor, or whether, you know, we don't need financial literacy because we can buy financial advice, right? So first of all, I completely agree with you that, you know, we make very important the consequential financial decisions, you know, and think about buying a house, right? I mean, many of the houses, by the way, in the Bay Area, you know, are huge financial decisions. But also our, you know, saving for retirement, managing student loans, you know, investing in an education. Consider how much, you know, an MBA would cost, or any other master or PhD, right? And the consequences of that higher income that they can generate, right, as really important consequences. And this is why we really need that financial knowledge. Because, you know, we want people to make decision in the same way which a CFO is making decision about money. Yes, we are not issue bond versus equity, but at the same time, we are making the type of decision in evaluating all of these choices where we can use basically the same instrument. And I think it is important that we do it as rigorously as possible. This is what we teach in our personal finance course. And in that sense, the world has changed, right? Because in the past, we didn't have to make decisions about our pension. You know, we didn't have this complex, for example, mortgages that we were facing now. You know, we didn't have all this difficult financial instrument in which to invest. You know, think of how many mutual funds we have now. So in many ways, this is why, right, we need this knowledge now with respect to the past. Now, how about financial advice? I actually think that financial advisors are not a substitute to financial literacy. They are a complement, because if you, first of all, do not have financial literacy, it might be hard for you to get the right advisor. And I've seen this because we actually did a special course for athletes, and in particular football players. And some of the reason why the football players actually went bankrupt is because they had advisor who provided very poor advice. And rather than helping them, they put them in very risky projects that ended up not being very savvy strategies. So, you know, first of all, you need to know how to make this advisor work for you and not pay excessive fees. And second, you know, you also kind of, you know, I feel that if people don't really have financial literacy, they might not even go to financial advisor, because they wouldn't really follow up potentially on this advice, or really understand the quality of the advice, or also understand the incentives that advisor have. You know, if you are providing advice and your advice depend on in a proportion of the wealth that you are going to, for example, manage or so on, right? Rather than a fee only, then there could be, you know, bad incentive as well for the financial advice, not to mention that the asymmetric information that we know exists, right? You are speaking to people which are first of all, you know, not financially literate, it might have also all kinds of biases on top of it.
Yeah.
Right. And so how do you really help people? That's why, in my view, that if you look at the market for financial advice, it's very small in comparison to the big financial illiteracy that we have. And the way to fill the gap is to increase the level of financial literacy so that people feel comfortable and can benefit from the financial advice.
Yeah, so I want to get into the policy issues here. But before we do that, so I want to get some sort of a, you have a lot of data here, it's cross-sectional data, which I found really fascinating. So to start with, sort of cross-country, cross-sectional data, and you already mentioned that we don't find a lot of difference across the two. I mean, I think you look at 150 countries or those. So you know, we have 200 countries. 150 is a big chunk of that 200 countries. But you don't find a lot of difference across countries. Is that the right way to think about it?
Yeah. So what I found, I mean, clearly there are differences, you know, between when you look at, we were very lucky to do a global financial literacy survey, and we did it in 2014. So, you know, really time to do another global survey because this is now 10 years later, and that survey still is the only global survey. And we got really some striking result potentially, which is that, you know, even across the world, financial literacy, you know, even among the countries that belong to the G7 or the developed countries, we don't find this high level of financial literacy. Mm. You know, it is striking in a sense that, you know, you expect that people in this country, because they are facing all of these decisions, right, they would be more financially literate than they actually are. Even though I find this, again, less surprising now, because, you know, if we don't have this knowledge in the schools, it's hard to learn by ourselves. And I think overall the world, I think in many countries is changing very fast, but, you know, many institutions are not keeping up. And so, for example, you would not be surprised, and I wasn't surprised, that it's the country with a very strong education system. And I would say even the country that care very deeply about their citizen, like the Nordic countries, that have actually a higher level of financial literacy, right? I would say, you know, it's the country who care about their people, who have very good education system and also have high level of financial literacy. And it's not because they have more advanced financial markets, right? But that strong education system, I think, is a very important predictor of basically the financial literacy. But overall, you know, financial literacy is not that high. And also we see very similar finding across country. For example, there is a gender difference in financial literacy almost in every country around the world. Mm. You know, so this is a sobering finding. You know, and we see low level of financial literacy also among the young. When we compare it to the old, it's not always true that the young are the one with the lowest level of financial literacy. So, for example, in the more developing countries, we see that the young even have higher knowledge than the old. Mm. And potentially it's because, you know, the young might be able to learn now more via technology, or, you know, they might have more access to schooling than that older generation. But when we compare the young in the developing country with the young in the developed country, we see a big difference, right? So in a sense, we need to invest more on that knowledge of the young, because overall it's not very high either in the developing country or in the developed country too. And then we also see a difference between people with low income and low education. And that, I think, is also worrisome, because everybody makes financial decisions. And if you have little money or little wealth, then you have to make that money even more work for you, right? And you need even more those skills in order to be able, you know, to really use the financial system in your own favor and use that money in your own favor.
Yeah, so I can see the education angle, Anna Maria. So you say Financial literacy is correlated with education, so that I can see. But literacy, financial literacy correlated with the wealth is a bit more complex question. So if I'm making only minimum wages, my objective function has very few parameters. I just need to make tomorrow, as opposed to a millionaire in New York or San Francisco trying to figure out how to invest his or her money. And so wealth is a much more complex question. And that goes into sort of developing versus developed world, right? So if you survey people in developing countries like India or Malaysia or someplace like that, against Scandinavia, we are going to find very, very low financial literacy in the former case, but their objective functions are very different compared to the latter, right?
Yeah, so this is a great question, but this is why it's so important to ask the most basic questions, right? So what have we been able to do? You know, when you do a global survey, right? What do you ask, right? Countries are so different. And this is why I think it's really important to ask the fundamental and universal questions. And this is why interest compounding works everywhere.
Yeah.
It's a math law, right? It has to do with how financial market works. And they work, you know, similarly. And even in the Arabic country, in a sense, you know, there is a way in which this contract work, you know, but using more or less the same logic, right? Inflation, of course, works everywhere. You know, when prices increase, everybody gets poorer. And risk diversification, you know, we can ask in a different way. Of course, we cannot ask, you know, whether a stock is, you know, riskier or safer than a stock mutual fund in Malaysia or in Ghana, right? But we can ask the same question, which means, you know, you shouldn't put all of your eggs in one basket, or what is riskier, like as a strategy, right? So in many ways, these concepts are fundamental and universal, and we want to know, but do people know this concept? So that's why it's important to look at the ABC and look at this law of finance, which are true everywhere. I couldn't ask about knowledge of pensions because pensions are very different across countries, or financial instruments are very different across countries. But these basic laws are really the same across countries. And also, since they are what drive the financial, in a sense, markets, people who participate to those markets, in a sense, you know, should be able to know or to report these laws. So I would say, let's not underestimate, you know, the savviness of a person who has to manage, you know, a small amount of money, or a small entrepreneur, versus potentially a richer person, but they all face the same, in a sense, working of the financial markets. So, you know, of course, I'm not surprised, right, that the financial literacy is lower, because, you know, people are, you know, they might understand the mechanism, but they might not be as articulate in answering these questions. But for example, what we found is what you really expect in countries that have experienced, for example, high inflation. They have a really high knowledge of inflation, even though they are the developing countries, right? And so, you know, people, when they experience some of these characteristics, they really know. And so, you know, that, you know, we have seen knowledge working in the way we are expecting.
Yeah.
You could argue that the ABC might not be enough for a Scandinavian country or a rich country, but the problem is they don't even know the ABC, right? Mm. So let alone the, you know, Black-Scholes formula to price options. So the problem is, it's not that people, you know, should have sophisticated knowledge, which they certainly should. They don't even have the most basic knowledge. And that's the problem that our kind of research, I think, has uncovered. You know, even in very wealthy economies with high saving rate or so on, people don't even know what inflation is.
Yeah, so inflation is a complex phenomenon in many ways. So let's talk about the US demographically. I was really fascinated by some of this this metrics. So men against women in terms of financial literacy in the US context. So what do you find there?
So we find yet again the gender difference in financial literacy. And I know, often people are surprised because they feel, but women, it's women who manage the family budgets, right? And that's absolutely true, but normally it's the men who also make the decisions about, let's say, buying a house, saving for retirement, investing. And this gender difference, by the way, is not just specific to the US, as I've said. Basically, we see a gender difference in most countries around the world. But let me say one important thing about this gender difference and what originates this gender difference. Because it's so prevalent around the country, we started focusing on it a little bit more. And what we notice is that it's not that women answer incorrectly to the financial literacy question. And I have to specify that when we ask the question, we don't ask people to make a calculation in their head or so on. We list a list of options to which people have to choose. And then we also list the option, I do not know, or I refuse to answer, which is very important to do methodologically because we don't want people to choose at random. Right. If I give you a question and I give you three options and I say choose one, you can just simply choose at random. Right. So we wanted people to express that they don't know the answer. What we saw disproportionately in every country is that women are a lot more likely to choose I do not know. And I actually think it's a beautiful finding because women do not know. But they know they do not know, right? And so they are more
They're
willing to
truthful.
admit it.
They're truthful. Yeah.
They are truthful. And what we did in one project, we took away this option and we forced people to answer. And then we ask, how confident are you on the answer? And what we found is perhaps what you indeed are already expecting, which is that women actually, over not still less than men, but they know the answer to these questions. Remember, some of these questions are super easy, right? But they are not 100% sure. So they are not confident on the answer. So if they are not confident, then they tend to choose, I do not know. It doesn't mean they don't have any knowledge, right? They have some knowledge, but they are not sure 100%. So what we have found, and we have been able to calculate this, is that one third of the gender difference in financial literacy is actually due to confidence, not lack of knowledge, right? And I see this in my classroom as well. When I ask a question to the class, I see a lot of hands going up, but it's mostly the male student, not the female student. And so when I pick on the female student, I say, can you try to give an answer? They actually normally give a right answer, but didn't raise their hand. Now, this is still important though, because if women feel that they are not sure, they might not act upon that knowledge. And that's also what our research shows, that both knowledge and confidence matter in financial decision, and in particular in decisions which are complex, like investing in the stock market. So we found that, women, by being less knowledgeable and less confident, they are less likely to invest. And both knowledge and confidence matter. So in other words, if you're not confident, then you don't act upon your knowledge. And so, this lack of confidence and knowledge, in a sense, hold women back. But it also means that when we want to do financial education program, in particular for women, we need to make sure that we are fostering both knowledge and confidence as well.
Yeah, so this is so fascinating. So I want to sort of touch on the policy aspects of this. So we got nearly 8 billion people around the world. And if a large percentage of them are holding suboptimal portfolios for whatever reasons.
Right. Yeah.
It's holding the world back from a GDP growth perspective. And so all governments, all policymakers should take an interest in this, right? So it is not just the billionaires and trillionaires that we have to worry about. It's the 8 billion people who are holding suboptimal portfolios for whatever reasons. Their portfolios are not an efficient frontier for many, yes, many different reasons. And if you have a policy that can push them to the efficient frontier, then we could have a huge GDP bulge all around the world, right?
I very much think so. I very much think so. And this is why, for example, we were in Europe recently to speak about this topic at the informal meeting of the finance minister and central bank governor of the European Union. And they are very interested in the capital market union in Europe, right? And indeed, what we do see is that people are not even participating to the financial market, let alone being at the frontier, right? You think it's not that they hold very suboptimal portfolio, meaning they don't even invest in the stock market. If you leave your money, by the way, in a saving account today with, you know, the type of inflation we have seen in the past, right? This is, you know, clearly, I would say not an optimal portfolio, right? It's an optimal portfolio under very, very specific circumstances, but also you're not growing your wealth, yeah, right? And, you know, and also if we think that, you know, investing, by the way, is one of the topics that people know the least. And, you know, when these people participate, they might indeed, for example, buy individual stocks, you know, they might indeed buy the mutual funds with the high fees. So there can be many ways in which indeed, you know, this portfolio is going to deviate from the efficient frontier, and we will have an effect on the economy. Lack of growth, as you say, and lack of financing from the firms, lack of also growth of wealth for the individuals, so that, you know, if these people are not saving enough for retirement, there are also costs to society. And, you know, this is also related not just to managing, for example, saving and investing in the stock market, but it's also related to the debt and debt management, right? Yeah. For example, people carrying a balance on their credit card. You know, I don't know a lot of stock that paid 23% interest rate risk-free, but if you pay off your credit card, you are going to have a really high return on paying off your credit card. You know, and we have so many, you know, way to borrows, in particular in the US, right? So, you know, all of our wealth management is very important. I think it's very important for the well-being of individual, but also for the economy itself, for how the economy would develop. I also would like to argue another thing, which is, first of all, I think it will be a benefit for the economy and for everybody. We can, you know, if people invest in the market, for example, we could have, you know, firms be able to support better. We could have the economy grow. But in finance and in financial illiteracy, I think an ugly part, for example, of financial illiteracy is this is a field where we see a transfer from the poor to the rich. Mm. Let me give you an example. You know, when interest rate went down, right, the people who refinanced their mortgages were disproportionately the high income people.
Yeah.
Right. And the low income people might not have had maybe the capacity to pay for the fixed cost, or they might not even know that it was beneficial for them to refinance. But as a result, because they did not refinance, banks could offer and broker could offer even a better, lower interest to those who refinance, right? Many instruments, last week we were seeing a paper now that, you know, for an older person, you know, you are remodeling your home or you are making more expenses to be able to stay home in your older age and to better take care of yourself, you can take this as a tax benefit, right? Who took this tax benefit is the high income people versus the low income people who had those expenses, but somehow, you know, didn't, in a sense, you know, take that into account. So, you know, even taxes are very complex, right? Mm. And you can have a lot of tax benefit, and you should be careful also about your investment to be tax savvy. And I'm afraid that the tax savvies are those who can afford tax consultant, and the other people might be paying more. So not only, in a sense, we are not growing very much, but we might be transferring wealth to people who are already wealthy. And in a moment in which the economy is very unequal, perhaps that's not the type of transfer that, as a policymaker, you know, you want to really be behind.
Yeah, so I'm not suggesting this, Anna Maria. So I'm just sort of thinking about this. So suppose we find that 20 stocks and half a dozen industries in your portfolio has sufficient diversification, and any margin diversification that you get by adding to it is pretty marginal. Let's say I'm just making hypotheses. So we could create some sort of heuristics that could lead people to efficient portfolios, even though they may not really have the time to understand all the mathematics around it, right? So I think what we're lacking, in my view, are simple heuristics to get people closer to that efficient frontier. And is there some sort of policy intervention? You know, people are going to go nuts around this, because if the government comes out and says, hey, you buy only 20 stocks and six industries, this is going to raise hell all around the country. But I think given the status quo, that might be a better option. What do you think?
Yes and no. In the following sense, I do think that we need to address this problem from every angle, right? It's such an important problem, right? So in a sense, I like what you are doing, which is that let's try to simplify. Let's try also to give people kind of, you know, good options, good heuristics, you know, good rule of thumbs, so that they do better than what we are doing now, which is no investment at all. Right. So that's, I've got to be better than this, and so on. The reality is that personal finance is personal.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I've really seen and understood from my student is that when you give this rule of thumbs, right, as every rule of thumbs, you know, rule of thumbs can be very clever, by the way. Right. Yeah. I mean, they're, you know, very good and clever. I don't think that people really appreciate what is going on. Right. Yeah. So, you know, they might buy into this, and then they might mess up, because since they don't really know what is going on, then they buy, you know, they buy other stocks, which are actually very similar to what you have, right? Or where they find themselves in a different situation, they don't know what to do, and that we are back to square one, right? And sometimes I wonder whether, you know, this, in a sense, without, to me, it's like, I always say financial literacy is like reading and writing, right? It's not, you know, if many, you know, many years ago, when you had to decide whether to make, right, education compulsory, right, because the world was becoming so complex that if you weren't able to read and write, right, it would have been very difficult. Right. I mean, we cannot simplify the world enough to say, just write your X here. Like, you don't need to be able to write, you know, we'll make the world simple. The reality is, this world of investment is so complicated that I think it's very important to have at least the ABC, so you know what you are doing. And also, I don't want to argue, which is, I think, one criticism that people have said, that, you know, well, but we cannot make people become expert. The reality is, you know, we are not asking people to be expert at all. But if you don't even know what a stock is and does, then asking you to buy 20 stock, right, might not give you the type of, I think, knowledge or put you in the right track. So, you know, we should try to, you know, do everything is in our power, I think, to help people, push people toward, I think, behavior that are, you know, welfare enhancing. And I, you know, even though it's super hard to say what is a mistake, right? I mean, if you have little wealth, probably it's not a mistake not to participate in the market. If you have maybe I see that you have money in your checking account, but in fact, you have this money because you are planning to buy a house, you are sending your child to college. And so it's not that, you know, it's always inefficient, but there are situations in which we can think is inefficient and, you know, and we can help you. But, you know, without that basic knowledge, I think it's hard to make this behavior stick and also to truly help people. They will find a way to, I think, undo that later on.
Yeah. So do you have a sense of, you know, suppose we figure out a way to push all 8 billion portfolios to the efficient frontier? Do you know, the sense of what that does for GDP growth worldwide?
Yeah, it's a great question. And this is where I would, you know, we need to see more data. We'd like to see more data, which is try to link the financial literacy to aggregate variable.
Yeah.
You know, so far, a lot of the research has linked financial literacy to behavior at the micro level. And so, you know, at the macro level, we know less. And so I cannot give you that figure. But I am confident that, you know, if we were to do this and to do this calculation, that it would be an important part of GDP. And this is, I think, why policymakers should pay attention to this. And I think they are paying attention. I think what policymakers, I think, are paying attention are the cost they had to pay, you know, for example, to rescue people when they made poor decisions. Or, you know, what they had to do when the economy shut down and realized that people not only weren't able to face a big shock, they weren't able to face a small shock. And so, you know, many didn't have like the money to, you know, put food on the table the next day or the next week, right? And so not only we don't save for the long term, we don't even save for the short term. And people, you know, also suffer from a lot of scams and fraud and so on, which, you know, for many politicians, this can also create a problem, not to mention not saving enough for retirement now that we have this shift in pension. But I think, you know, policymakers should think not just in this way that, you know, they are paying costs to individuals, that they are also paying costs because, and these are less visible, unfortunately, because people are not making the best financial decision. And this could translate in higher GDP, in higher growth, because there could be kind of more saving and better financing of the firms. And this could be an important way to do so. One of my, wish and so on is to add financial literacy to the national statistics.
Yeah.
And use it as an indicator of how well a country is doing.
Yeah.
Right. In the same way we look at GDP per capita, in the same way we look at consumption, in the same way we look at growth, I think when you look at financial literacy, you can actually sense how well this country can do. Right. Because if a lot of the population, half of the population, for example, is not financially literate, this is not a good indication of the potential of this country. And I think it's also an indicator that policymakers should look at if they want to do well and if they want to have a solid growth. And also if they want to have a resilient society, as we are all coming to, you know, see and believe, you know, after all of these pandemics, after the shutdown of the economy or after this rising inflation, right? Are people able to face shocks? And I think that's a very important question. And it has a lot to do with also the financial literacy of the population.
Yeah, so I haven't really thought through this, Anna-Maria. So we look at macro phenomenon. So the Federal Reserve is focused on inflation, things like that. There is a micro phenomenon here, which is sort of inefficient portfolios of a large number of individuals. I'm just throwing this out. I haven't really thought through this. Is there some sort of an agency that could focus on this problem, like Federal Reserve?
Well, absolutely. So I'm so glad you asked this question. So 80 countries have now set up a committee on financial literacy.
Yeah.
And normally it's a committee that does a national strategy for financial literacy. And, you know, I have to say, in many countries, this committee has too little power, if I have to say, and too little money. So it's important to have it, but, you know, it can do a lot more, right? So, you know, I'm thinking maybe, and I think unfortunately, it's too, you know, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, I think is, you know, one example, but it seemed to be more protecting consumer than potentially doing all the type of policy that one can think of, right? So I think some of this committee, if change, I think in their structure, I think, you know, they have tried, they've been set up mostly to coordinate a national strategy. But I think this national strategy now can really, you know, make this additional step of providing, you know, also help to the policymaker for the country to grow more. Because, you know, if you look at the future, like this is part of, I think, of the new economy, right? This new economy is driven by individual as well being given more responsibility. And as a result, you know, we have to do a lot more at the policy level. And so I think it would be an ideal potentially role for this committee, which at the moment I think are probably not structured in a way that allows them to have the power, to have a lot of power, or maybe to have also the support that allows for this type of policies.
Yeah, so very quickly, I know you have to go. So it's sort of a global phenomenon. So I was wondering, is there some sort of United Nations type entity that looks at all 8 billion people? And suppose we construct, you know, sort of a efficient frontier for the world and try to figure out, you know, how to make it more optimum. Right. This is a true economics question. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think one of the global institutions which has been driving this policy has been the OECD. And by the way, I'm not surprised that it's a global institution looking at this. And I think one of the reasons is when you look at financial literacy, it's going to pay off in the long term.
Yeah.
And so policymakers often have too short of an horizon to do that. You know, and I think now they are doing it because they are starting to pay the cost during their own time. You know, when crises happen, you know, they are paying the cost right away. And this is why I think everybody is a lot more aware of the importance of financial literacy now that, you know, after the financial crisis, I think this has really become more relevant. But in the World Bank itself also has done this policy, particularly for the developing country. Interestingly, the United Nations as well recently has taken up this policy or thought about this. It came out actually when they were thinking of education for the young. And I think it's, you know, super important because indeed this is so important and disproportionately so for the young generations, right? They are clearly facing a very different world, right? They are also living longer, they are facing technology. For them, this is, you know, of utmost importance. But I think we do need as well this coordination at the global level. So hopefully there might be a lot more coordination so that, you know, this is really pushed at that global level. I mean, I see this, as I mentioned, it's happening at the European Commission level, across the European country, is happening at the OECD level. But I think, you know, countries like Africa, countries, you know, in other developing countries, this is, you know, incredibly important. And these people, and this country have an incredible resource, which is young people.
Yeah.
Right. And so we need to make sure that, you know, those countries can indeed achieve or be set in a position, you know, to achieve that result, you know, also in terms of investing, I think, both in human capital and in knowledge, and investing in the financial market as well.
Excellent. Yeah, this has been great, Anna Maria. Thanks so much for spending time with me.
No, thank you so much. That's been so wonderful to be able to talk to you.
You still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. but thank you so much. So Gil, what you do, I know, I don't know that we need to edit, you are right. And then you are